This is MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's Russ White.
Thank you, Hannah. Here's Michigan State University President Luana K. Simon and Spartans Athletic Director Mark Hollis with MSU's Provost June Hewitt.
It's really our pleasure to welcome June Hewitt, who has been willing to take on the role of provost over the past few months, but is a well-established administrator and also someone who's been very active with educational issues and child development for a very long time. So they all sort of fit together sometimes. It's like having a pediatrician as the dean of your College of Human Medicine that seems to work at moments. And so June's been an architect, really, of the neighborhood concept that we keep talking about and what it means to sort of think about 21st century university learning. So and your children are a part of that.
Very much a part of that.
Part of that experience.
Different neighborhoods,
your kids are in different neighborhoods, and they've had different experiences. So why don't you just talk about what does it mean to be in a neighborhood as you think about Michigan State and particularly undergraduate education, June?
Well, the neighborhoods were an obvious evolution for MSU, in part just because of the geographic makeup of the institution. A few years ago, I was in a meeting where they were talking about, some housing folks were talking about neighborhoods. And what they meant by that was just breaking up the 25 residence halls into sort of manageable configurations of housing. And at that time, I said, that's too small an idea for this. If we're really going to think about putting people in neighborhoods, let's think about what happens in neighborhoods and how people live in neighborhoods and the kinds of support they have in neighborhoods. And that really was the beginning of thinking about this model where academic services and student support services were integrated in ways that provided all the kinds of things that students needed in one place for academic success. So we're worried about how they make the transition to MSU. We're worried about how they're being supported in their classes, the decisions they're making about classes, how they're feeling. Are they well enough to go to class? How is their stress? It's everything about students in terms of social, cultural, and academic transition to MSU. And what I know is unique about the MSU model is that it isn't about a one-stop shop. It's not a mall where you can go into one door and get one kind of help or go into another door. This is a set of people who've been cross-trained to care about how you make your transition to MSU and to guide you in the direction you need to get the support that you need. And I think that's what's unique about this and why it's working.
I've reached that point in my life where I keep saying back when, but back when I was a student, our first came to Michigan State, it was kind of like going to camp. You signed up and you were provided a cabin to live in, and you went off to that room, and that's where you went. You had to navigate campus from that point, which was called home. I think today, at least the experience with my two students is they had an opportunity, and I guess they had an advantage growing up close to this place, but chose very different lifestyles of how they wanted to start their career at Michigan State. TR wanted all the help he could get, so he wanted restrooms one way, a cafeteria a certain place, wanted to have opportunities to work out, and he chose kind of an approach there. My daughter kind of wanted a different lifestyle, wanted to put a little more academic edge into it, wanted to be around some folks where study was at the forefront of everything else. And it kind of gave them options to look around campus and really feel a different feel. And I think that's kind of what you want to have with the neighborhoods while providing the services that are needed to achieve academically as well as all the other activities you're associated with.
That's exactly it. Because while we want all five neighborhoods to be of the same high quality, we don't want them to be the same.
Right.
Just as You can all live
like
in
the Animal Kingdom and the Magic Kingdom.
Well,
they're both awesome, but they're
but
different choices.
They're different choices.
Yeah, think about Epcot.
Okay, Epcot. Yeah.
Well, I was kind of going to do the New York analogy. All right. You know, so they're all Spartans. They're all New Yorkers, but they live in different neighborhoods.
Sure.
So each one does have a different feel. Each one has a slightly different culture, and you can shop around and find the one that is. Feels like it's home to
right.
you. And some of that is dictated by the residential colleges that are located there or proximity to other colleges. For example, the West Circle area is very much influenced by the arts and humanities mm-hmm. because we have so many music students who want to live there so they can run across the street in the morning in their pajamas and go into the practice rooms.
Mm-hmm.
So that's that neighborhood, and that's we enjoy that.
Right.
But Brody has a different feel, as does, you know, East. But they're all really interesting places, and they're developing in interesting ways.
Where in the – this is maybe an unfair question, but I'm known to ask unfair questions. Where – what do you see in the future maybe for Michigan State or for others as far as on-campus housing, neighborhoods, things that maybe are a niche that maybe is missing right now that – that would be a nice addition to Michigan State or might be something that other campuses are looking for? Do you feel like we're capturing all of the different living environments, or are there some out there on the horizon that may be a different system that might fit within our environment?
Well, I think we still have room to explore. One of the things that we know we'll do in the next short while is to create some new housing for families, and graduate and professional students, as Spartan Village is getting older and older and will have to be replaced. But we have many fewer student families, but that's still a very real need.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll certainly attend to that, and we understand that. I just had a conversation with someone the other day about honors housing, and we have lots of honors floors on campus. Is there a way to make the ways and the places that honors students choose to live a little more distinctive?
Mm-hmm.
They're embedded in neighborhoods, and they're embedded across campus, and so maybe that is the model.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe we should pull back and think about, is there another way to do that? So we have lots of questions, and the neighborhoods are working. But it's just the foundation. It's just the infrastructure. Now we need to really think about how these places operate. A great example is that next year, Communication Arts and Sciences will open a new living and learning program that will be a 2-year program that will be based on the Media Sandbox.
Mm-hmm.
And it will be housed in East Neighborhood in Hubbard. And really, the entire lower level of Hubbard will be turned into a sandbox. And so you'll live upstairs and play downstairs. But that play will be about your classes and your work and your projects. But if you want to work on that at 2 in the morning, there'll be a space to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So when you think about this integration, truly, I think we're redefining living and learning. I think before people thought living and learning, as we did in the early 60s, was about having residential space and classrooms in the same building. And that was the first step in the evolution. But we're looking at something much more vital now.
Mm-hmm. June, we're part of a national project on STEM education with AAU. There's an alliance discussion. There's a flagship university network on undergraduate education. As you've listened to people around the country, how unique is what we're trying to do?
I don't think anyone in the country is trying to do it at the scale we're trying to do it. And that probably is the difference. And the other part of it is I don't think anyone is working on as many fronts. Sometimes you create several pods of excellence. And then those pods, as they expand, begin to converge. And that's what's happening here. I think we have enough innovation going on in undergraduate education in terms of STEM education, student success initiatives, what we're doing around supporting students for graduation, our work in preparing students for the next generation workplace, the T work that we're doing. We're doing enough things that when this all converges, and this is purposeful, okay? This isn't random. what we will really have is something here that is an undergraduate experience that I truly believe is unparalleled in this country in a public institution at this scale, open to all. And that's going to be pretty exciting. I think we're writing the book now.
When you go through this process, how do you balance how the faculty wants to teach and how the student wants to learn? How do you mingle those two, what I would assume to be different avenues in some cases, maybe a lot of crossover, but how do you engage the two in such a way to develop, like the sandbox is a perfect example of which I'm very familiar with, but
I think that there's enough innovation on the campus and enough curious faculty that they're often there's a critical mass. Mm-hmm. And as some of these innovations become more accessible to other faculty, you know, there's always a group of leaders, right, mm-hmm. who are the first out of the box. And sometimes they're being chased by students and sometimes they're being led by students. But again, that's a critical mass that's growing. We have more and more interest in faculty doing different kinds of teaching and asking for different kinds of support in that. So that's one of the things we've talked about is really creating, we talk about a sandbox for students. Right. We'd really like to create a playground for faculty. Mm-hmm. So they could experiment with different kinds of pedagogy and space and technology. And there seems to be a lot of interest in that because there isn't one way to do this. There's right. lots of ways to do this. And it's going to look very different whether you're in philosophy or whether you're in chemistry. And so there are opportunities here for everyone, but it's not going to look the same. Even if all of our dreams come true, it won't be uniform.
And the great thing is once you hit that innovation piece, it does attract the best faculty and it does attract the best students. Mm-hmm. And that's what you want to get to.
But also, if you think about the role of a university is also having you encounter things that you believe you don't like, mm-hmm. and being able to find the tools to be good at them. Because the world will not be structured in the way you like it.
No question.
And really what distinguishes, if you think about the world of competition for jobs, for success, once you leave a place like Michigan State, it is your capacity sometimes not to do the things you love well, but to do the things you don't like to do better than anybody else. Mm-hmm. And that will distinguish you among all the people who want the job because they love to do the thing that's a part of the job, or they're able to grow in a company or in a community because their first job had this one set of passion skills, but the second set comes back on some very traditional styles of writing and reading, literature, the arts, because they were in many ways would say forced to do it. Mm-hmm. But became very valuable in a space down the road. And that, I think, is what distinguishes an education at a place like Michigan State from some other places, in addition to trying to do that, as June says, to scale, and then adding all these new innovations that are part of the teaching learning process. Mm-hmm. And your phrase is what? High-impact learning systems? Is
strategies.
That strategies.
High-impact learning strategies. So... Mm-hmm.
So why don't we step back for a moment and we mentioned STEM. And there's no community around, no economic development organization that doesn't say STEM. What do you see the role that Michigan State's playing in looking at STEM education at the forefront of some of these conversations?
Probably our most significant contribution, and I'm measured in saying that because I think we're making a number of contributions, but is really the discipline-based educational research, which is around trying to understand how students learn science and mathematics. Because clearly in this country, we haven't been completely successful in helping students achieve the levels we'd like them to. So
I have a 14-year-old that could help as a research project
all
for
right,
you.
All right. We've got a subject, huh? Put them under the microscope. So how do students learn these concepts? And when they don't learn, why do they not learn? And are there other ways to structure how we teach, in what sequence we teach, and the ways that we teach? Mm-hmm. So if that is at the core of what we're doing, it really trying to understand how this happens. And then on the other side of that, in both K-12 and at the university level, then how do you create curricula and pedagogy that deliver what you just learned? So what I think we're doing here that is pretty unique is, again, at the core, we have this research center that has its mission to understand. And then we're working with K-12 schools and trying to better prepare teachers to work with K-12 students. And at the university level, we're working with both university-level instruction and university-level curricula. So it's really an entire system. We're trying to contribute in all places, but at the core of it is the research base. Lots of folks are working on teaching methods, and that's important. But if it isn't connected back to fundamentally understanding the cognitive processes, then it may not be nearly as successful. So that's our contribution. And we have about 80 people on campus right now that are funded in some sort of a STEM education project, which is significant.
How much connection do we have as an institution? I know through the College of Education, but with teachers that are in the classroom and preparing and learning and exchanging. And it seems, as an outsider, it seems like a very abrupt transition from K through 12 as a parent to college, and requires almost a reboot system to hit the college environment. And I assume different school districts have different input that they're delivering to Michigan State, but I'm just curious how much dialogue would take place between our faculty administration and K through 12.
One of the things we've done for several summers is to provide on-campus opportunities for high school teachers to come to MSU and to learn about the teaching of science and mathematics. So besides the well-trained teachers that we're providing to the state, and we have a significant influence on the state now, and you know, in time we will see that make a real difference as we produce teachers that are trained differently. It's not that teachers who've maybe been in the field for a long time are not strong teachers, but they haven't had the opportunity to perhaps learn what we know now. So it will eventually make a difference as we see our students penetrate those districts. But we have several opportunities for teachers to come now and study in the summer, and that is greatly appreciated by the school districts and by the individual teachers, and we get really good feedback every year about that.
This is MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.
And you're listening to a conversation between Michigan State University President Luana K. Simon, Spartans Athletic Director Mark Hollis, and MSU Provost June Hewitt.
One of your areas of research as a faculty member was sort of looking at the younger kids and the influences of parenting and environment on student success. So if you were providing advice to Mark the parent, since we've already identified that he has two here in different neighborhoods with different expectations, but both doing well, but finding their way slightly differently. And he has another one on the way who...
On the way, meaning he's in high school, not on the way.
Oh, good. Okay. Oh, good.
I did want
no
to make
shower.
No announcements today.
That is sort of in this age group of high technology, high social media.
Multi-screen,
yeah. But not necessarily seeing themselves as learning some of the fundamentals of mathematics is easy because it's not so sure why he might need that moving forward. Unsure of what he wants to do in life.
Mm-hmm.
So as you think about...
You know him well.
No, but he's not unique.
I mean,
he's a prototype. and we have a number of those who arrive on our doorstep, very talented, very bright, which your son is.
Right.
Very talented, very bright, but having all of this, both stimuli as well as experiences that all seem to be sort of
a cacophony in their head about what they should do. So as you think about your research about parenting as well as your sense, because I know you talk to parents through an orientation, both formally and informally, sort of what advice would you provide, you know, for people thinking about their kids coming to college 4 or 5 years from now, 3 or 4 years from now?
Well, so the advice is different where they are, right, in the life cycle.
Yeah.
If a lot of my work was done with parents of very young children, and at that point, the conversation is about read to them, then read to them, and then read to them, mm-hmm. because you can't do it enough. And then it's about involvement in school. There's many findings over long periods of time that families, parents, caregivers, guardians that are more involved in school have children that are more engaged in school. And involved means whatever that means, whether it's going to parent-teacher conferences or checking their homework at night or reading the messages and sending the right stuff in the backpack. All of that makes a difference. High expectations, messages that they can achieve, that you expect them to achieve, supervision of homework. So all of that is at the younger end. And then there's all of the cultural enrichment. And it doesn't matter what it is. 5 minutes in a museum, 30 minutes in a museum when children are young, which is about all they can manage, mm-hmm. Is a significant experience. Because the next time, because it generates curiosity. And what your strongest goal with young children is to stimulate curiosity. You want children to ask why.
So if you're obviously very good at that.
Yes.
Right?
Well, right. and you all are high achievers, so therein lies the
evidence. And I still ask why all the time. Why is this?
And you will never get old, because as long as there's something else to learn and it's fun, there's something else to get up for. Mm-hmm. So, but when you have a 14-year-old and you've developed all that, then there are some other issues around discipline.
This is spoken from a mother who's got 2 in graduate school,
yeah,
and 1 through the process.
Pretty easy at that point.
Through the pipeline.
Well, yes.
Different
and no.
Different challenges.
Yeah, and they'd be happy to tell you what I did wrong, right?
Right.
But you know, there really isn't a problem with bright, curious kids who don't know what they want to do. Because that's really okay, right? Because they have options. And so it's about, at this level, sitting down with kids and saying, you know, what do you really enjoy? What do you – oftentimes, one of the things that helps kids make decisions about what they want to do is to talk with them about what they really don't want to do. Mm-hmm. You know, what are the things that absolutely you can't imagine yourself spending time on? Mm-hmm. But asking them what they're most curious about and what are you most interested in is aligned to that. Because when you look at our faculty – who are some of the smartest people in the world, mm-hmm. what they really are doing is they've spent their entire lives studying the thing that interests them most.
Yeah.
And I still remember sitting in a classroom as a high school student when we talked about the impact of poverty on the development of children and the ways in which poverty impacted their learning and their – it was this long conversation. And I didn't know you could actually study that, but I decided that was the most interesting thing I had ever heard. And I wanted to figure out, so do people really, who learned all of this? And who did this research? And what are these people? And what do they do for a living? And, you know, fast forward, right. you know, a few decades, and I'm still talking about it. So I think this business about what interests you and what are you curious about, and then how do you stimulate that, is probably the thing that people maybe get tired of doing after elementary school, after the LEAF project and the diorama and all of the rest of it. But those are the really important conversations as teenagers.
I think one of the things for me that is a concern about technology is that when students now are doing searches, the search engines are so precise.
Mm-hmm.
That you enter a word and you get an answer.
Mm-hmm.
And you think you have the answer and you're feeling a lot of pressure to get on with it because the screen's flashing and the tweets are coming and all that stuff around you. And one of my pieces of advice is, as you think about your kids and technology, get them to ask 5 words for the search, not 1.
Mm-hmm.
And read part of that, because their question and their learning isn't as precise as the word they just put into the to put whatever search engine it is. And there's a false sense about sort of knowledge and knowledge understanding that I think comes from that precision of the response back in the search engines. Mm-hmm. And so if you can get your kids to use that technology in a more powerful way.
Right.
And ask, you know, and do three more words or, you know, and broaden the search parameters, so to speak, in the technological speak, then you begin to let people explore some things that aren't exactly what they thought they understood they wanted to do, but might ignite that new passion. And that's the piece, I think, as we move through technology and education, or if I had a, you know, students who are old enough to really understand that, it's that, and that's where you sponsor a little bit more curiosity.
I think I could even take that from a dad's perspective, and watching Friends. I believe this has no research validity whatsoever. It's my hypothesis. Dad's hypothesis is that children are driven in many aspects by fear of failure, and they will stay away from things that may interest them because of the fear to fail. And as they take the technology, as President Simon was talking about, they can structure the use of that technology in a way where they're going to win. They're going to put the one word in and they're going to get the win. They're going to play the game. They're going to get the win. Then they come to campus and they're engaged with many other students that are very high achieving as well. And they're told, these are the best times of your life. And they think for a minute, is it really? And those are conversations that as I meet with students, I really try to get them to open up, not student athletes, but students on campus, meeting with ASMSU or meeting in classrooms about these are the best times in your life. There's going to be good times after these, but you need to talk. You need to express your feelings. You need to put the screen down and tell me, I'm afraid of something I really want to do, but I'm afraid to try. And
I think that comes from, and we're an example of it. I mean, there is an emphasis on test scores and grade point averages and things. Our admission standards are in the middle of the Big Ten. People ask me about that. Our rankings would probably be better if we moved them up a bit, and we could do that by encouraging more people we're not going to admit to apply. We could do that by a common application, which people will check the box, and whether they know our name or not, they would be an applicant. But I'm also very pleased that we do a holistic admission, so it's not simply taking the top X
right.
number of people by grade point average and test scores and saying to them, you're it,
right.
and the ones who maybe not have been as successful. Still, who have done other things have their records read in a particular way, and June's been very much a part of that balancing act, because it is a balancing act as we're more and more attractive to students.
Mm-hmm. Well, because we know that students who have those high test scores did get the right answers.
Right.
I don't know if they understand how they got there or why they got there or if it mattered.
Mm-hmm.
But if that's all we look at, and that's important, I won't deny that that's important because it is often evidence of students who are really, really capable.
Right.
But when we look at the record more holistically, we see that there are students who have learned all kinds of things that we never measured
mm-hmm.
and that they bring other kinds of things to this community and are able to share those with other students so that they can learn.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we really try to do when we build a class, is to think about if you were going to assemble a group of people who could not only learn from what we have to offer, but could teach one another and could teach us,
mm-hmm.
what's the group you would assemble?
Right.
That's hard. But
and I think achievement and setting levels in academic pursuits are extremely important. I think what's happened with children is we've added so many other variables at young ages. You know, it used to be the only thing I was afraid of in high school is asking a girl to dance and she'd say no. And now it's you've got to make the travel team. You've got to do this. If you don't make the travel baseball team, you're a failure in baseball. And it's really – there are so many different variables now that kids are having to deal with away from being a child and being defined as success or failure. Mm-hmm. And that's coming to our doorstep.
Yeah, and they didn't create any of it.
They didn't create any of it.
That was all of us.
All of us, no question. Yeah.
And I think going back to the beginning of the conversations, one of the things that is underlying the neighborhoods is that there are lots of ways to encounter knowledge and to pursue passions and interests in an environment as rich as this.
Mm-hmm.
Without it being a course with a grade.
Mm-hmm.
Courses with grades are very important. They are going to be the coin of the land, so you can't ignore them. But they don't have to define sort of your entire experience here.
Right.
And if we can continue to push through the neighborhoods with greater academic engagement, or you think about service learning,
mm-hmm.
Or the experience of studying abroad and somebody coming back and saying, I really want to do something else because
right.
I saw this in this setting.
Yeah.
All those things contribute to sort of getting over this fear of failure,
mm-hmm.
but also contributing to the broadening of perspective and talent that really does spark people's passions when they leave here. And as more and more academic things are in the neighborhoods, for example, use TR space over in Brody, he can wander in and look at the RISE program and environment mm-hmm. without ever taking a risk about taking that course.
Right.
Right.
Exactly.
He can wander over and think about a language without ever having to take a risk that
– right.
that he's going to fail at Chinese.
Well, I think Coach D and I, as parents, what do you see? And I responded with connectivity and independence.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And it really has allowed young mm-hmm. people to come and take what they've developed mm-hmm. through their family and through life up until that point
mm-hmm.
and become the person that they are. And I've seen that with my children. I've seen it yeah. with all their friends. And it's a remarkable transition that's mm-hmm. been delivered through the neighborhoods.
Right. And I think that's what we're really good at without mm-hmm. sacrificing the competitiveness in a marketing degree, because TR's marketing degree
right.
needs to put him competitive with anybody in the world. But it's that combination. And going back, June was really one of the key architects of this entire concept. And as we're nurturing it along, there'll be other iterations and variations of that will come into play in the same way that June has been involved in the Smith Center and mm-hmm. continuing to push the support of student athletes so that we have lots of people to celebrate at the academic banquet.
Exactly.
Absolutely.
So we appreciate you joining us.
Oh,
so,
you're welcome.
This is MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.
That was MSU Provost June Hewitt talking with Michigan State University President Luana K. Simon and Spartans Athletic Director Mark Hollis. To hear their conversation again, please visit SpartanPodcast.com. Up next, Dr. Kirk Heinze talks with Grand Rapids Mayor George Hartwell.
You're tuned to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.
This is Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's Dr. Kirk Heinze.
Well, Russ and I are back in Grand Rapids for something that we look forward to very much every year, our annual visit with Grand Rapids Mayor George Hartwell. Mayor Hartwell, always a pleasure to see you.
Well, thanks, Kirk. Great to have you here.
Well, George, let's get into it here if we could. First of all, congratulations. You were recently named, I think back in November, to a presidential task force on climate preparedness and resilience, and you're the only Michiganian on that task force.
It's a real honor to be on the task force. There are 8 governors, there are 14 mayors, and 2 county senior county officials, and 2 tribal leaders from all parts of the country. In fact, as far away as the territories of Guam, the governor of Guam, and the governor of Hawaii. We've got a tribal leader from north of the Arctic Circle in Alaska. Both coasts are represented. I should say all coasts are represented, the Pacific Coast, the Atlantic Coast, and the Fresh Coast here in our Great Lakes area. We had our first meeting, and what's fascinating is that, you know, there's this single cause of climate change, but its manifestations are multiple. So the governor of Guam is talking about losing islands to rising sea levels. The tribal leader up in the Arctic is talking about the urgency of moving entire communities because their food stock that they've counted on for millennia is gone. The fish, the seals are gone as the water's warm. The mayor of Salt Lake City talks about his concern over where they're going to get enough water to for their people in the future. And the mayor of Des Moines, Iowa, talks about what it's like to experience 3 500-year floods in 2-year period. It's a fascinating group of people to be working with.
Well, one of the reasons clearly that you were named to this task force, I mean, you, your administration for many, many years now, you've been looking to the future, recognizing that climate change is real. There's really no scientific debate anymore as far as most people are concerned. You have been moving in the direction of preparedness for quite some time across a number of fronts.
Well, it's true. You know, I think those of us who've been engaged in this work for the last decade or so started with a fundamental commitment to mitigation. That is, climate change is a threat, and if we do enough right now, we can mitigate its impact. Along the way, I suppose maybe now 3 years or so ago, some of us started saying, whoa, wait a minute. There are already impacts that we're facing. This isn't a future state we're talking about. It's our current reality, and we better start doing something about it right now and adapting to meet those changes. Now, initially it felt kind of like waving the white flag. You're saying, well, we're going to give up on mitigation. But as you begin to implement your adaptation strategies, you find that they're all about mitigation too. I mean, the more people we can put on great public transit and get out of their single driver, single vehicle cars, the better we are. The more we can do with in terms of preparing ourselves for extreme rain events and being ready for that, the better our climate is going to be generally. So mitigation, adaptation, I think, go hand in hand.
Well, speaking of severe events, over the past year since we last talked, you had a pretty tough one here in Grand Rapids with a lot of water over a long period of time that really challenged. But I think all the news accounts were that you folks responded with alacrity and with a lot of sophistication.
We came through it quite well. I mean, it was a historic flood for us, and our flood walls held. They were strong enough. They were high enough. It didn't breach the flood walls. We've identified areas of weakness that we are now in the process of shoring up, as it were. But where most of the damage took place, Kirk, was out in the neighborhoods and not at the river's edges. It's a stormwater management system that's just not engineered and built to control, to manage the sudden burst of water that you get in a major rain event like that one. And so it backs up in the streets, it backs up in people's yards, it gets into their basements, and so that's where we saw the majority of the damage as a result of this flood.
So sort of an existential moment ahead of this task force. But what is the goal or the objectives of the task force? How long will you meet, and is there going to be some kind of report or recommendations that will come out of it at the end of the process?
It's a time-constrained commitment. We have 1 year to do our work, charge coming directly from President Obama. We the president has been very clear that, and if as you listen to his State of the Union address, it became very clear to the whole country that he expects that what he's going to get done in the next 3 years, he's going to get done largely through executive order. That Congress is has proven itself to be sort of intransigent and unwilling to work with this administration. And so he's very focused when it comes to this climate work on those things that he can do as the President of the United States without having to go up to the Capitol Hill to get authorization. So our charge, I mean, it's not entirely limited to those things he could do by executive order, but we know that's where we can have the greatest impact.
Well, let's move from the task force here to the city of Grand Rapids. In your recent State of the City address, one of the things you addressed, and I don't need to explain to you all the dimensions of sustainability, but you talked specifically about retaining talent in the city of Grand Rapids for young people who graduate from Michigan colleges and universities. A little bit about talent retention as a key player in sustainability.
Sure. So my objective is to get all those graduates from MSU to come over to Grand Rapids. Sorry, East Lansing. No, I think we all know that we are we're going to be better, stronger cities if we have a base that is well educated, and so for me that starts all the way down at pre-K, and it's the kind of investments that need to be made in those earliest years when children's brain development is most rapid. And so Grand Rapids' own Susan Broman, who's the governor's office of early starts, is that what it's called, I believe, working with young children, the youngest children, did a phenomenal job of bringing $52 million into the state of new federal money for pre-K opportunities for children, 16,000 more slots for children. Then we got to make sure that when they get to school that they're reading by third grade. The cliche is from kindergarten to third grade you learn to read, and from third grade on you read to learn. And we've got to be sure that those kids are learning ready by the time they get to third grade. I've got some programs working with high school students, both in employment opportunities, giving them real work experiences. I've got a mayor's youth council that's a sort of an in-depth, year-long civic education that these kids get, and it gives me a chance to get their perspective on the world, which is very helpful. And we've just launched a new initiative with that involves getting young people through college. We found we can get them into college, but the dropout rates or the fall off rates are disturbing. And so, what do we do to make sure that when they go to college, they complete college? Because we know that when they come back to our city, here's the stats for Grand Rapids. Every 1% increase in our population that has a post-secondary degree is worth $117 million a year in additional earnings based on averages. So we've got to keep building that population of bright, educated young people who are going to lead this city into the future.
Another thing that another passionate issue for you, I know, from your State of the City and for most Michiganians, infrastructure. It doesn't matter what political party, it doesn't matter what religion or what philosophical persuasion, people are sick of bad roads and bad bridges and bad railroad tracks. What can we do to get the legislature to move on infrastructure improvement?
Grand Rapids has an opportunity. Our voters approved a 5-year, 0.2% increase in the income tax, which had three specific purposes: police, fire, and city transformation. We're coming toward the end of that, and we're going back to our voters, asking them to continue that 0.2% and dedicate it to streets and sidewalks in Grand Rapids, streets, bridges, sidewalks in Grand Rapids. That will generate about $9 million a year for us, which is on top of the roughly $6.5 million we get now, gets us closer to what we need. But we need $22 million a year over the next 15 years to bring our streets up to the condition that you would say is a good condition, where they can then be maintained without extraordinary investment in bringing them up to a quality standard. That question will go before our voters on May 6th of this year, and I'm very encouraged from what I'm hearing now. People are indeed fed up with the condition of the roads and ready to make some investment.
Yeah, you can speak of the Grand Rapidians. Most of the people we talk to on the show and people I talk to, whether they're farmers, housewives, small business people, whatever, I mean, 201, are willing to pay more. Just come up with a plan. We'll support the plan, but give us something that we can support.
Right, and ensure us that you're not going to do a bait and switch, that you're not going to take money that you're currently dedicating to streets, for example, and go off and spend it on something else. So, this city commission here in Grand Rapids, when we meet next, will adopt a set of guidelines that guarantee that these monies will be spent for what they're intended to be spent for, and that no money will be siphoned off, if you will, for from the street fund for other purposes just because there's a new infusion of dollars.
Let's turn to this intractable problem, which really isn't intractable if the legislature can get their act together. But something very good that happened in Grand Rapids, among many things last year, you opened a downtown market, and it is fabulous.
Thank you. You've had a chance to visit, Kirk, and spend a little money there, I hope. Maybe after you leave here, you can head over there and spend a little money. It is an absolutely gorgeous market. It has the outdoor seasonal portion for fruit and vegetables in season. And then inside, everything from cheese stores to fish markets to bakeries to restaurants, it's just a fabulous operation. MSU has an important presence there, educational presence. We have there's a rooftop greenhouse also that's used for educational purposes as well as production of fruits and vegetables. So it's a great venue.
Let's move to another thing you mentioned in your State of the City. You're looking at some solar panels on, I think, an abandoned landfill to generate energy for over 1,000 homes. That's a pretty exciting proposition. Where does that stand right now?
We're looking at a project that would put solar panels on 38 acres of that 170 acres. That would be our start to generate 2 megawatts of power off of that abandoned landfill site. The status is a small grant was received from the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, EPA, that allowed us to do preliminary engineering work. We've shown it to be feasible from an engineering perspective. We've got next week we're meeting with a developer that's is going to present some financing options for the project. Does it make sense for the city to own and generate the power? Is there a public-private partnership that could do that? We're famous for that here in Grand Rapids. We've learned to do that well. Or is it simply a privately developed project and we buy the renewable energy? There are a number of options. We're beginning to explore those. It's my hope that we can start construction in the spring of 2015 on that project.
Wow. There's one thing, too, and I'm talking with George Hartwell, the mayor of Grand Rapids. We talked about last year, and it was really an interesting project, and I know some progress has been made, but restoring the rapids to the Grand Rapids, or to the Grand River and the Whitewater. I know it's ongoing, but where does that project stand?
Yeah, I frequently have visitors to Grand Rapids coming here for the first time and saying, Gashmere, you got a great town, but where's the Grand Rapids? And they're gone. We tamed them over 100 years ago. And it made sense at the time to do that for commerce, to tame those rapids with dams. But it doesn't, those dams aren't functional anymore, and we're in the process of figuring out how to safely remove them and restore the riverbed, the natural riverbed, with the rapids that cascade down over 18 feet from the north end of downtown to the south end of downtown. And I think it's going to be fabulous when it happens. Where it stands right now is that we, in 2013, we got a designation from the federal government as an urban waters federal partnership project. That means that there's about 12 or 13 federal agencies that are dedicated to working with us on clearing the hurdles, on finding the funding, on making this project work. The most intractable problem that we've bumped into so far is the invasive species questions. The dams do keep the sea lamprey from migrating up to tributaries where it can spawn, and we have to find a solution that addresses those questions. But the whole notion of restoring the rapids, of bringing people to the river, getting people in the river, connecting, I think, in a very spiritual kind of a way with this incredible natural resource that we've got here in our Grand River. Kirk, I think it's going to help redefine who we are as a people living in this place, or maybe recapture who we once were as a people living in this place.
Well, our time has run out. George, it's always a pleasure to talk to you, to come up here once a year and get a report on your wonderful city of Grand Rapids. Congratulations on being appointed to President Obama's task force, and have a great 2014.
Great. Thanks so much, Kirk. It's just always a delight to see you.
That was Dr. Kirk Heinze with Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. There's more online at mlive.com/environment.
Sundays at 4 o'clock, it's MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. MSU Today is a lively look at MSU-related people, places, events, and attitudes put into focus through conversations by MSU President Simon, Spartans A.D. Hollis, sustainability-focused Dr. Kirk Heinze, and me. MSU Today every Sunday afternoon at 4 o'clock on AM 870 WKAR. Thank you for listening to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Please visit us online at SpartanPodcast.com and join us every Sunday afternoon at 4 o'clock for MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.